You're listening to This Week in Palestine. I'm your host, Anne Lucas. Good morning, good evening, wherever you are in the world. You are listening to This Week in Palestine, and I am your host, Anne Lucas. Today's show is a show of conversational interviews with people we admire. And when I say people we admire, I mean the person doing the interview admires the interviewee. I was actually speaking with a friend of mine over dinner the other day. She's also an activist for Palestine, and she spent time in the West Bank. And she was really just bemoaning how awful everything had become. It just gets worse and worse. She thinks it can't get any worse, and it still gets worse. It got me to thinking that finding the mental and emotional stamina to keep standing up for Gaza in the United States can feel impossible at times. And taking the time to reflect with friends and people we admire that share our values helps. Listening to wiser voices who have fought longer and harder and are still at it reminds us that we can keep going and we must. I think of this as an exercise in refilling our well of resilience. So in the first half of the show, we'll be refilling our wells by listening to part of a conversation entitled Beyond the Rhetoric, Standing in Integrity. And that is a conversation between Daniel Mate and Norman Finkelstein. Daniel Mate being the younger generation of anti-Zionist Jewish activists, of course, greatly admires Norman Finkelstein, one of the giants of the older generation. For the second half of the show, we'll be refilling our wells as I share part of a conversation I had with someone I admire, my good friend Awad Awad from graduate school. My friend Awad is a Palestinian-American who is a consummate Arabic pedagogue. But now he's also the inaugural director of the Salaam Center at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. At a time where Palestinians' lack of agency is at the forefront of our minds, I'm really hoping that seeing and acknowledging where their agency exists and seeing how it's making a difference can help keep us in perspective. We've got a lot to listen to, so yalla bina, let's go. The interview conversation between Daniel Mate and Norman Finkelstein I'm sharing with you this week was actually published just a few days ago as one of several special conversations released recently in coordination with the release of the documentary entitled Where Olive Trees Weep about the West Bank. The filmmakers, Mauricio and Zeya Benazzo, specifically hosted these conversations as part of their film's release. They described their film as giving background to the current crisis in Israel-Palestine by bringing to light the lives of people they met on their 2022 journey in the occupied West Bank. Their universally human stories speak to the intergenerational pain, trauma, and resilience of Palestinians. In this interview conversation, Finkelstein and Mate discuss the lies of propaganda which obscure the reality in occupied Palestine, from the distortion of history to the whitewashing of war crimes in Gaza. So we're going to hear the first half of this conversation. You're going to hear from the filmmakers first, introducing the talk. They will introduce Daniel, and then Daniel will introduce Norman, and it will go on from there.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening. Welcome back. My name is Maurizio.
Hello, everyone. My name is Zaya Benazzo. We are the directors of the film Where Olive Trees Weep. And this is day 19 of us coming together and learning and listening and getting inspired to take stance and action in support of our Palestinians, brothers and sisters. So welcome back.
Yes, and we are speaking to you from the Anzvil settler in the unceded territory of the Coastal Miwok and South Pomo.
Indigenous people
known as Northern California, Sebastopol. So we want to introduce you today to first to Daniel Mate, which is going to run this
Two very special
two very
guests
special
here
guests.
with. Hey, Daniel, thank you
Hi,
so much.
both.
Thank you for
Yes.
offering to facilitate this conversation.
Yeah. So let me introduce Daniel. Daniel is an award-winning composer, lyricist, and playwright for musical theater. Outside of the art, Daniel runs the world's only mental chiropractic service, Take a Walk with Daniel. He co-authored the New York Times best-selling book, The Myth of Normal: Trauma, Illness, and Healing in a Toxic Culture, with his father, Dr. Gabor Mate. The two Mates' next book is entitled Hello Again, A Fresh Start for Parents and Their Adult Children. But most and foremost, Daniel is a co-host of the world's most moral podcast, Bad
Must be
Asbara.
so. How appropriate. I love the name.
Yeah, that's my latest venture, and I joined up with Matt Lieb, who's a comedian in Los Angeles, who started the show, and I was a guest, and we hit it off so much that I ended up becoming a mostly full-time co-host. And yeah, every week we just try to digest and spit out whatever is coming at us from the Israeli PR machine. And in a sense, it's weird to be making comedy in a time like this, but at the same time, the feedback we get from all kinds of people, including people in Palestine, and even some people in Israel, is that it's cathartic and homeopathic
What
somehow
protects
to be able
people to
to,
listen?
to laugh. So yeah, thank you. It's really my pleasure to be here. And like I said to you guys before we went on air, you thanked me for being willing to do this. I said, interviewing Norman Finkelstein, I'd do that for a bad cause, never mind for a cause as good as this one. So here we are.
Thank you
Thank
so
you.
much.
So I guess that it leaves it to me to
Introduce, yeah.
it leaves it to me to introduce our next guest. I don't have a bio in front of me, so I'll just do this from the heart and from memory, from what I know. Norman is a hero. Norman is Professor Finkelstein. Norman is a renegade and just a stalwart defender of facts and truth. And the title of this conversation was it was we didn't choose it, but someone else, I think the folks at SAN, named it Beyond the Rhetoric: Standing in Integrity. And I can't think of anyone who's stood more in integrity for longer on this topic, particularly when everything material would incentivize against that. And that's, I think, the definition of integrity, than Norman Finkelstein. So, Norman, pleasure to be coming at this with you from different parts of Brooklyn. How are you today? And thanks for doing this.
I'm fine, thank you for having me.
Yeah. So, why don't we start with the title that was given to us just as a jumping off point? Beyond the Rhetoric, Standing in Integrity. What does that title evoke for you when it comes to the topic of Israel-Palestine in the moment we're in? What do those words suggest to you or bring up for you?
First of all, what's most needed now is clear analysis of what's going on and where things are headed. And what's least needed right now, not that it's ever needed, but certainly least needed right now, is prophetic statements and rhetoric. Things are moving simultaneously at a glacial pace. And at lightning speed, both facts are true. The kinds of change one might have hoped for, given the various arenas of resistance to what Israel is doing, be it the Houthis and the Hezbollah on one front and one level, or the ICJ at another, the International Court of Justice and the International Criminal Court, another level and another arena. The UN organizations, the whole UN system really, UN system, it's quite a fascinating thing to observe. The entire UN system, and that means all of its organizations, of which there are too many to count, the UN High Commissioner on Human Rights, the UN Undersecretary for Humanitarian and Emergency Affairs, UNICEF, Save the Children, World Health Organization, UNRWA, you know, it's a vast apparatus, and this whole apparatus is united in support of the people of Gaza and against the Israeli genocides. That's another whole area. And then there is the grassroots resistance, which was most salient in the spring with the student uprisings, the student revolts. Given all of that, one would wish the impact were greater than it has been. So things are moving at a glacial pace, though I don't believe it's correct to say that it hasn't accomplished anything. I believe that it's correct to say it's accomplished a lot, but not, it hasn't yet crossed the threshold where one can breathe a sigh of relief. So at one level, things are moving at a glacial pace, but at another level, every day there are new developments. It's very hard to keep up, even just with the written documentary record. It's impossible at this point. Every day there's a new 100, 200, 300 page single space report that's coming out. And at some point, you just throw up your hands in despair and say, well, this is going to be superseded in about 1 week, so there's no point in even reading it. Navi Pillay released it's really two-volume report on the situation in Gaza and in Israel on October 7th. And the first report on Israel on October 7th, I think it's about 70 pages, microscopic font, single-spaced. And then the one on Gaza is 130 pages, microscopic font, single-spaced. And then about a third of the topics she addresses in the report, she says, I will return to it when I give my report to the General Assembly. So that means another report, I think it's scheduled to be released in October. And that's going to render obsolete. So I usually read everything twice or three times. This time, I left it up once because I said I was going to write about it because I had a lot of disappointment with that report or parts of the report. But then I said, you know, in 2 months, there's going to be something twice this size coming out.
Yeah.
You have too much other stuff to do. So every day there are new developments right now, the talk of the town, as the New Yorker would put it. It is an impending or possibly impending war with Hezbollah in the north, in northern Israel and southern Lebanon. So things move at a very rapid pace, and one needs clarity, I believe. And what's least useful at this point is, not that it's ever useful, but least useful at this point is vacuous rhetoric.
Yeah. And what about the integrity piece? I want to come back to rhetoric with my next question, but you've spoken about there being two orientations towards life, basically. One is the materialist concerns at the forefront. Let me get what I can get. Let me make my life as comfortable as I can make it. Let me look out for myself, which is an ordinary and, you know, in and of itself, understandable human orientation. And then there's something to do with putting principles ahead. And many people look to you as a paragon of that second choice. In this moment, for you, what does integrity mean when it comes to standing with?
Integrity means one thing to me at this moment. I receive a large amount of email expressing gratitude for what I've done. And normally that would massage the ego. And for me, it just means strengthening the resolve. I've not done enough. I've got to do more and do more and do more. I've been working pretty hard. I'm working on esoteric topics because I think that they can possibly have an impact. And it's the kind of work that nobody likes to do. And I am willing to do, and to some extent, I like to do it. It's a kind of my leisure is devoted to watching British murder mysteries, and I like a good detective story. And so a lot of what I do is trying to figure out how people in positions of power manage to fabricate these falsehoods, which are then conveyed with a kind of flippancy as if they're not hiding anything, but in fact, they're hiding everything. And so it means going through a pile of dull legalese material and dissecting it. So there's this character, Joan Donahue, who was the former president of the International Court of Justice. And as you know, on January 26th, 2024, the ICJ issued a statement in which it, as everybody understood it, it said that Israel was plausibly committing genocide. There didn't seem to be any dispute on that point.
No, Israel sure acted as if that's what they said. I mean, they tried to claim that they didn't, but they reacted as if they had just been plausibly accused of genocide.
That's absolutely correct.
Yeah.
And then on April 26th, Joan Donahue was no longer the president of the court. Her term of office came to the end. She went on this British BBC program called Hard Talk. And she said, we never said Israel was plausibly committing genocide. I'm thinking, wait. I read that statement many times. For those who are interested, paragraph 54 is very clear in what you said. What are you talking about? And of course, that caused serious disruptions in the so-called narrative, a word I completely detest, because now you can claim the authority of the former ex-president of the court who actually presided over the statement by the court, what's called the order, saying that's not what Israel concluded. And I sat down, I read through the whole record, which is pretty extensive now because the ICJ met on the same case in February, then met in the same case in March 28th, met in the same case May 24th. There was the public sittings and there were the written submissions. And I read through the whole record. I wrote a 22-page single-spaced analysis, and there was only one conclusion. The conclusion is that Joan Donahue uttered a shameful and shameless lie. And right now that I've completed that, and by the persons in my reckoning who count, they conveyed that my case I argued was persuasive. I'm now on to this creature named Julia Sebutindi, the vice president.
Is that the Ugandan?
Yes, this creature from Uganda, she's what you might call a bad stenographer for Israel. She's so over the top in her apologetics that it's become even a bit of an embarrassment, such that in the first meeting of the court, which was March 26th, there was the majority opinion, there were separate opinions, and Judge Barak from Israel, he wrote a separate opinion. And then there was only one dissent. The dissent was Julia Sebutindi, which we can mix a metaphor. She was more pious than the Pope. Barak did not issue a dissent, only her from the majority. Now, of course, you're entitled to issue a dissent. Everybody's entitled to that. The question is, how do you argue it? And she didn't argue. She didn't argue at all. She wrote 7 pages, single-spaced, which is large for a dissent. But she just repeated everything Israel said and never explained why she didn't agree with what the majority concluded and why she didn't agree with that phalanx of UN agencies and respected NGOs. I left out, I don't know if I mentioned, there's WHO, the World Health Organization, they're Save the Children, there is Oxfam. They're all united on this.
Yeah.
So why are they...
Norm, lest we get lost, lest we get lost in the microscopic here. You know, clearly what you're describing there is not integrity. You know, you wrote an entire book called I Accuse about Fatou Bensouda, previously of the, was it the ICJ or the ICC?
She was the chief prosecutor of the ICC.
Yeah, exactly. And I didn't notice until you held up a copy of that book, the very clever, just the visual of I Accuse has ICC right there in the title. It was just very, very clever branding, I have to say, Professor. But integrity for you means not flinching and also not being satisfied or too gratified by the praise and gratitude you get, but rather pushing ahead and pushing forward. So if you don't mind, I'd like to take the conversation a slightly different direction, especially because the launching pad for this conversation is this film that was filmed in 2022. And it was filmed largely in the West Bank. And I know your focus has been on Gaza for a long time, but you also have a lot to say about the occupation more generally. So maybe you could tell us a little bit about, and if we could sort of summarize it concisely, that'd be great. The lifespan of this occupation, what was predictable from the start, and where have things gone in new or unpredictable directions? What has stayed the same? What has changed? What is the life? What is the, if you had to tell the story of this occupation from its inception to now in a rather simplistic way or a rather simplified way, because I think I sometimes, because I grew up in a left-wing Zionist youth organization, despite the fact that I had an anti-Zionist father. It was a very strange choice he made to send us to Zionist summer camp, although I'm not mad at it. I learned a lot. I tend to have a certain kind of nostalgia for like the good old days when things were simpler or something like that, or when there was a peace movement in Israel or so on and so forth. And in those cases, I can flatten or elide the ways in which everything has always been as brutal as it is now. And then there are ways in which the brutality does seem to have ramped up or gotten more somehow purified and laser focused. I wonder what you have to say about just the trajectory of the occupation. And let's start, for the purposes of this part of the conversation, in 1967. There are conversations also to have about what started in 48.
My own view is that if you look at the conquest of the American West in the United States, the sorts of justifications that were put forth for it, the kinds of tactics that were used in the course of the conquest of the West, I don't think on fundamental levels, at a fundamental level, it differs very much in practice or in its unfolding. Many moons ago, several decades ago, I sat down and I read through the history as it existed back then, wasn't extensive, of the Cherokee Indians, and compared it to the situation in the occupied Palestinian territories in this relentless juggernaut-like conquest of land, the breaking of treaties that were signed It's actually a quite good book, accessible to a general reader. It wasn't written by an academic. It's called The Century of Dishonor by a woman named Helen Hunt Jackson, in which she describes this, as I said, relentless juggernaut-like process of moving west, signing treaties, making promises, breaking the promises, and continuing on the path. And I don't think it differs fundamentally from what happened in the case of the Israel-Palestine conflict. The one difference, I don't think it's a major difference, but it is a difference. Because of what happened to the Jews during World War II, there was a kind of moral persuasiveness to the case, which is not, didn't have that magnitude of moral persuasiveness in the case of the U.S. conquest or the Euro-American conquest of the American West.
The full talk between Daniel and Norman, along with other talks in the series, are published by the organization SAND, which stands for Science and Non-Duality. In the show notes of the podcast, you will find links to accessing the full talks, as well as ways to watch Where the Olive Trees Weep. My interview discussion with Awad Awad was long and far-ranging, so I'm going to share some of it this week and some of it in future shows. I knew Awad from grad school. We both cut our teeth in and around the Near Eastern Languages and Cultures program at UCLA. I have always known him to be a very passionate pedagogue in Arabic language and culture, but more recently he became the director of the Salam Middle East and North African Cultural Center at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. In this discussion, we'll talk about the center and how he runs it, and what its role is at the university. But we will also talk about his background as a Palestinian American, and how his particular history put him on his vocational path that brought him to the Salam Center. At this point, the Salam Center is really quite a unique phenomenon, and we'd really like it if you could explain to us what is the mission and function of the Salam Center at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign.
First of all, thank you. So to understand the context of the center before getting into the particulars of the center and how I got to the center. So there's a couple of different types of cultural centers, if you will, in the United States. The first are on the academic side, and they are more of the interdisciplinary centers, like your centers for Middle Eastern studies and so on and so forth. And they came about after World War II, when we really became an empire and the government was like, okay, nerds, tell us what's going on. stop being in your siloed departments, right? We're going to create these centers, fund it, and you guys can put on academic stuff, but also cultural things. So those have been around for a while, and most major universities have them. And then you have your community-based centers, like Elif Institute, for example, where I used to work at in Atlanta. And what most of those do is it's just more of a community center type, but also to educate the public about who we are. And most of them are not academic in nature at all. So what they end up doing is perpetuating national narratives. And then you have the centers that similar to the one that I direct. These centers are extremely new when it comes to the Middle East and North Africa. There's only like maybe five or six across the country now. These centers are housed either in student affairs or in offices of diversity, equity, and inclusion. And so think of your multicultural center on campus, on the student life side, on the student affairs side. And their history dates back to the civil rights movement and the advocacy of the Black community, the Black power community, in establishing these centers. And then that snowballed into having Latino centers, Native American centers, Asian American centers. And we are the newest of these centers to emerge. And we're only, I think, less than 5 years old. But we expect to have about 20 of these centers pop up in the next 5 to 10 years for two main reasons, or three main reasons, really. One, there's a huge need. Second, with the passing of the U.S. MENA category on the U.S. Census, it will, in 2030, it will show an even greater need for our communities to be serviced. And what we're noticing as well is, you know, drives for these centers have been there for a while, right? As a result of especially after 9/11, it just takes a while for them to pick up speed and for the administration to actually establish them. What we saw with Northwestern and Rutgers with their negotiations and ending the encampments is they've negotiated having a center similar to the one that I direct.
Wow, I hadn't heard that. That really speaks to how important the work you're doing is at the University of Illinois. I'm genuinely curious, though, how you got to the definition of region you did. Middle East, North Africa is a pretty common go-to, but there's lots of debate about that, lots of other options that have been put forward, and I'm just curious how that's been working for you, especially because it's the students that really have to identify it for themselves.
Oh, it's really interesting, right? Because one, the first question you ask yourself is, you know, what the hell is the Middle East and North Africa? And depending on who you ask, the borders change, right? If you're asking the U.S. military, then they have it divided in a certain way based on their commands. If you ask a modern historian, the borders are different. And depending what frame of references they're using, right, as a modern historian. If you're talking about, you know, linguistic barriers, or if you're talking about, you know, the League of Arab States, the borders change. For me, yes, the Middle East and North Africa as a term has colonial roots, right? We just happen to be in the middle of the East between Britain and what they owned in India. And we've adopted that term in the Middle East as well. But no, what we do at SNM is actually extremely unique. The borders of countries are drawn by colonial powers, and we will not allow colonial narratives to tell us who we are. And therefore, you have no maps inside Sudan. Once those borders are drawn, you colonize yourself, called nationalism. And what nationalism does is you define yourself against an other, and the other is usually your immediate neighbor. It's the Hatfields and the McCoys, right? And most of the time when you're defining yourself against an other, if you take those same group of people and you throw them in a supermarket and you come back an hour later, their shopping carts will look almost identical.
That is so very true. If you live in Texas, frankly, even in New England, if you look at my cart, I'm going to have a bunch of Mexican food stuff in there. Same as if you're in Mexico.
You know, and so we don't have any flags inside Saddam either. Instead, what we focus on are two things: our shared identity, generosity, hospitality, those kinds of things. Coffee, tea, you know, even alcohol culture. We're not allowed to have alcohol, but we have symbols of, you know, the tamada in Georgia, the toaster, you know, symbols of winemaking in Armenia.
I keep Egyptian beer empties in my office displayed, both Egyptian Stella and Saada. These things absolutely matter. Egyptians believe they invented beer.
No, I don't have my empty attic bottle collection that I should have in Los Angeles. Otherwise, it would have gone up, you know, if it was okay.
It's really impressive, though. I mean, the real diversity of people that define themselves as Middle East, North Africa, and have really found a home in Salaam. It's such an amazing thing.
Or people have come to the center and considered it home if they are across the entirety of the Mediterranean, from Morocco down into the northern third of the continent of Africa, like say, for example, down to Senegal, go all the way across into the Sahel, the Swahili coast of East Africa, right? So Tanzania as well, right? Zanzibar and so on and so forth, Kenya. Go across the border of the Indian Ocean up into the Indian subcontinent. And when you get to the Indian subcontinent, honestly, what we've realized is it also tends to be sectarian, who considers themselves part of Salam versus who considers themselves part of the Asian American cultural center. This Hindu-Muslim split, especially with Modi, has really like exacerbated lines sometimes. Go all the way up into Central Asia, the Turkic stands, Kazakhstan, Uzbekistan. Then you go all the way across into the Caucasus and then to the Balkans, right? Ottoman Eastern Europe. So we take the word MENA, the Middle East and North Africa, as very border fluid. So you have everybody from this region and all of their diversity coming to Salam. People are meeting each other culturally for the first time, not just as people for the first time. You're hearing a bunch of different dialects of Arabic, right? And dialects of other regional languages as well. People are also seeing like interactions between undergrad and graduate student. You know, you get your community members that come in because they're visiting campus, you know, or visit, or they're here for graduation for their kids, you know, and then they come to the center and like, wow, we wish like we had this. And when you walk into the center, you'd think it's a cafe. I mean, we have people actually stumble in and ask for a menu.
You've got to be kidding me. That's amazing. Oh my gosh.
But for me, it's important because throughout the Middle East and North Africa, we're really big on cafe culture. And even in the United States, right, the trend over the last 30 years is if you're in school or if you want to have a business meeting, right, you meet at a cafe. Look at the plethora of Starbucks that have opened up, right?
That is so very true.
And so, yeah, you walk in and it's extremely cozy. There's a whole wall dedicated to musicians and words of empowerment and female empowerment and all different hair textures and skin tones that represent us. And, you know, a whole wall just dedicated also to Persian language and culture. Minorities from across the region really see themselves at home as well. We've had people meet and create their own registered student organizations just by them meshing, right? For example, now we have one of the newest or soon to be at another status now, a registered student organization, RSO, called Mosaic, which is made up, the majority of them are LGBTQ plus from the region, with some that were also born and raised here. And it's just like, it's amazing.
It is so amazing to me how you are building such a welcoming and diverse global community like you have there, and a lovely cafe literally anyone would sit in. Did you ever see yourself doing such a thing? Did you ever think you would be overseeing something that was so very global and diverse, but also so very local and meaningful for people in a specific place? I remember you being this just most amazing Arabic pedagogue, like really someone that was very dedicated to teaching language. I really had no idea you would go on to do something that's so much more diverse beyond Arabic language. But part of being a good language teacher is also being very hands-on, very practical, really getting into the human ability to do things. So I can also see why that would really make sense, regardless of where you are and what language you're dealing in. Could you say a bit more about kind of where you were coming from as a teacher of Arabic and what that taught you about, you know, being able to do the kind of work you're doing now?
Yeah. So it's a really new beginnings. And I honestly, I wasn't even looking for a job. I dedicated my career after 9/11, building, revamping, directing study abroad programs, domestic programs, and study away programs for Arabic for non-native speakers at the undergraduate level. you know, the government invested heavily after 9/11. They realized overnight that, hey, there's a shortage of Arabic speakers in national security. We might want to fund this now. And Arabic went from having 5,000 students roughly before 9/11 across the country to almost 35,000 in a matter of a couple of years. And that was when I first started taking Arabic in school. It was, you know, when I community college years, somewhere around 96, 97-ish. In 2003, I was at UCLA in the NELC program. And it was around the 2003 to 2006 where we saw the biggest jump. And so I just happened to be in a program doing Arabic and happened to be at the center of all of these as they grew. Spent, you know, most of my career with that. Realized that there's been a lot of advancements in the field of teaching Arabic, but there's also a lot of gaps that still exist. And so I created my own model addressing all of those gaps, the intercultural gap, the linguistic gap, and several others.
I hope that means you paid attention to teaching Arabic dialects.
Yes, I do. I actually embrace multilingualism. I'm part of Cornell University's Arabic Nas Academy that does an integrated approach. I'm really advocating that, you know, especially for the need of people like me who are heritage speakers, right? We're neglected in the curriculum, really. I mean, we haven't been fully reflected, let's say, or catered to. And so with that, yes, I think we should do dialect proliferation. Everybody should see themselves. Arabic is one language across the continuum. You have dialects on one side. Then you have your main dialect. You have other dialects that you may know or be exposed to. And then you have the literary form of Arabic, which is, you know, Fusha, the modern standard, and the classical and the written version, the oratory version. And then you have other languages that also are part of your own language, right? You know, so I always chuckle. And then depending on who you're speaking to, you're all across this continuum because language is innate to us as a form of communication. It's human. So we don't think of it anymore as Spanish here, French here, Arabic here. It's we're a really interconnected world. You're speaking with people who are multilingual. How do you communicate with them? Using all the vocabulary words and hand gestures that you know.
Thank you, because that's actually how language works in practice. When you're actually using it, you're using all the vocabulary that works, all the hand gestures that works. It is for communicating in the most practical way.
Yeah. So by doing that, it decolonizes language. And, you know, there's a lot of people that'll say, you know, oh, you're adding too much English into Arabic, you know. And I'm like, dude, you guys are the same people that had you lived in 9th century Baghdad, which is another topic of study. Like, you guys would have been up in arms and saying, you can't use the word musika and falsafa. That's not Arabic.
That is so true. No one walking around in Abbasid Baghdad could be talking about anything that was a topic of the day if you did not have access to Greek words while speaking Arabic. Part of a language's survival and sort of functionality on an ongoing basis has to do with its ability to be able to absorb these kinds of influences. We have managed to go all the way from Illinois, Urbana-Champaign to Abbasid Baghdad without actually talking about you, Owen. Every Palestinian family story is very unique, and I'm really dying for everyone to hear your family story.
So I was born and raised here in the United States, born right outside of Detroit and Ypsilanti, raised in Jackson mostly. For the first 13 years of my life, moved to California, where I spent the majority of my life afterwards. And then, you know, short stints in Las Vegas and in Albuquerque, about 7-8 years in Georgia, you know, and now in Illinois. My parents are from a small town between Jerusalem and Jericho called Ramun. The olive groves owned by our family are in the twin towns of Taiba and Ramun. Taiba, not to be confused, there's two different Taibas. One is inside Israel proper and one is near Ramallah. We're the one near Ramallah. That Taiba is one of the last all-Christian towns left in the entirety of the West Bank.
That makes sense because that is where Taiba beer comes from.
Exactly. Yeah, we're about 4 or 5 minutes from the brewery. and 4 or 5 minutes from the monastery where Jesus and the disciples sought haven after raising Lazarus from the dead. That's in a taiba. Our town, Ramun, right, biblical Ramunim, is associated with the Rock of Ramon, where the Benjaminites fled seeking haven. Interesting story. Around the Great Depression, there was a couple of people from our village who ended up, I think, through the Christian missionary networks, leaving to Latin America. One of them made it to the U.S. He would eventually go back and be the mayor of the town in the 60s and 70s, and we were one of the first towns in the area to have electricity because of him. And he helped sponsor a lot of people to come out. My great uncle was in Colombia. He randomly comes across somebody from a neighboring town because he thought we all perished after 1948.
Oh my gosh, that is crazy. Oh my gosh, really? Only Palestinians. That's the only people that go through these things.
He's like, no. We're, we weren't affected that much. A lot of us fled to the caves and yada, yada, yada. He starts to bring people to Latin America because the Johnson Reed Quota Act would allow the number of folks from our region to go to the United States. So my family ended up, mostly in Latin America. And then my parents were, and immediate aunts and uncles were in Puerto Rico before coming to the U.S. So I was the going away president from Puerto Rico. But what was interesting for me is I didn't realize until much later in life that I was weird. I thought everybody's Thanksgiving had Puerto Rican food, Colombian food, Palestinian food, and then your traditional Thanksgiving spread. You know, we would have kibbeh and grape leaves and hashwa stuffed turkey and mashed potatoes and corn and, you know, pumpkin pie, apple pie, roast lamb, sancocho, sopa de bacalao, tostones, you know, all of that was part of our spread, right?
You weren't weird. That literally sounds like the most amazing meal ever. You were really lucky. I am totally serious. That is the most amazing food spread I've ever heard of.
It's my favorite holiday for sure, and I love to cook, right? So it's like, yeah, come to Awad's. And yeah, and then I also didn't know that, for my parents, it was really important for them that they preserved our language and culture at home. We couldn't speak English to each other. We were at home if my dad was around. So I ended up like speaking a particular rural dialect that makes me sound, when I interact with some people, a very polite 60-year-old from a small town in West Virginia, right? Like Jim Tom on Moonshiners.
That is so funny. I had a similar problem speaking Egyptian Arabic at first because I initially learned a lot from watching, classic Egyptian movies, so like 40s and 50s movies. And that got me some very strange looks on my first trip to Cairo. But once I was actually in Cairo and watching the same TV they were watching and seeing the same movies and things, my Egyptian got a little bit more current. Although I don't know what was wrong. I thought it sounded fine. Even now, I still think I didn't sound super weird. But I don't get to be the judge of that, do I? But yeah, the media you consume makes all the difference.
Yeah, and then growing up at home, we were allowed to watch Ghawarit Toshe, right? A very famous Syrian character, right? And then we were allowed to watch the Jordanian Bedouin films, right? So Ghawarit is very slapstick comedy, based in kind of like in Damascus. And the Jordanian Bedouin film has tried to create this blanketed, unified Bedouin, TV dialect to unite all the different tribes. But it was also like, this is our real culture, right? So you can connect your Falahi peasant roots to this stuff here. We weren't allowed to watch Egyptian films because they had hash and they had belly dancers and it was haram and aib.
That is so funny. That's the entire reason why I watched all the Egyptian movies. That's what makes them so entertaining. But yeah, not just hash and belly dancers, also some really good music. But yeah, without those movies, you wouldn't know any Egyptian.
So I didn't grow up around Egyptian dialect. I grew up hearing Jordanian Bedouin, right? Or Palestinian Bedouin, or Levantine Bedouin, let's say. I ended up hearing a lot of Damascene Syrian dialect through these TV serials. Certain things, depending on the songs that we were listening to. So when I started to interact with other Arabic speakers, I was like, I've never heard this word before. I don't know exactly what you mean. right? I would nod and smile. I know my friends from Trablus, from Lebanon, you know, they would ask me in the mornings, "Yatrawat," and I would just say, "Alhamdulillah," not realizing "Yatrawat" means "Aftarit." Did you have breakfast? UCLA was like one of my the biggest phases of change in my life, and you know, I had friends from all over, right, from the Arabic speaking world, from Egypt, from Iraq, from Lebanon, from Syria, from the Maghreb, from you know, Turkey, Serbia, you know, everything, right? So it's like you're realizing how much we're similar, but you're picking up a bunch of these vocabulary words and cultural nuances. And you know, when I went home once a couple years after I started grad school, my mom was like, you know, in the straight like country Palestinian rural dialect, says, "Yamma, batalna nifham alayk, bitahki cocktail." So, "Mom, we don't understand you anymore. You speak in a cocktail."
Oh, poor mom. I actually really get a kick out of those kinds of, you know, preservations of highly local dialects that you get in the United States.
You know, I chuckled, right? But I bring all of these experiences into, you know, into my classroom when I teach. It was very important. Like when I was teaching at Santa Monica College, I built a program there. We had a lot of heritage speakers, you know, Coptic, Egyptian, but some of them it's the first time they meet somebody who's Muslim. And just the power of all of this interaction with each other, right? And then learning from each other and giving and taking and realizing how similar we are, right? We're not defined by our parents' generation's experiences. And we're American, but we're our own kind of American, you know, and just celebrating all of that, you know, together.
Just listening to you talk about your life experiences, I'm really starting to put together how well it has prepared you for the kind of work that the Salaam Center does. You know, I never really thought about how being Arab American means you're navigating a little mini United Nations of different identities and life experiences just within your own community, never mind the diversity of cultures in the larger contexts. And that's not even just about different Arabic speaking countries. It's about when people arrived to the Americas, maybe even where they arrive in the Americas. It's really so amazing to hear the cultural intelligence you've cultivated from just living in those contexts, but also the huge personal payout one gets from cultivating those kinds of multiple layers of cultural intelligence. Bringing that ability to just kind of naturally operate on a spectrum of both cultural and emotional intelligence seems like that's pretty important to the work you're doing at the center.
Part of the mission and vision of the center is creating and fostering critical intercultural citizens who are really able to better read the world, especially knowing the lens of power, whether it's skin tone or whether it's gender, whether it's sexuality or whether it's, you know, national origin and how all that works, right? Just acknowledging that it exists and knowing how to interact with the person based on their background. And then, you know, creating global stewards who, now that you're better able to read the world, how could you leave it a better place than how you found it? Tikkun olam, right, in the Jewish tradition. It's not naive, but it's hopeful.
Amen. Thank you so much for talking with me today, Awad.
It is my honor and pleasure.
Let's do this again really soon.
Inshallah. Thank you so much, Ed.
Again, Awad Awad is director of the Salaam Cultural Center at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. And as I said, this was a much longer conversation. And next week, we'll actually share some more about what's been going on his campus and with his center in light of what has happened since October 7th. We are officially out of time for this week. But I want to remind everybody that in addition to the radio show every Sunday, we are released as a podcast every Tuesday on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Pandora, all major podcasting hosting services. And yes, the show notes will have more information about the talk you heard from the SAND organization. It will have more information about the Salaam Center. And it's really nice that we can provide you with those kinds of additional resources through the podcast. So even if you're listening in the morning on Sunday, definitely check out the podcast just to see the extra resources we provide for you there. It takes a village to produce a show like This Week in Palestine, so I'd like to especially thank Stan Robertson and Bob Funk, with additional thanks to Steve Lowe and Mohammed Al-Ghul. This Week in Palestine is a production of Truth and Justice Radio, currently at the home of WZBC Student Radio at Boston College. We look forward to seeing you next week. Please take care. Thank you.
Thank you.